generous support for Coastal Windage comes from Cameron's Restaurant Pub and Inn, and now RV Park. Cameron's is the only true British pub on the coastside, featuring 19 beers on tap and more than 60 brands of bottles. Come for the food and stay for the fun. Happy hour specials Monday through Friday. Open mic night on Thursday and karaoke on Friday and Saturday. Cameron's Restaurant Pub in Half Moon Bay.
It's summer on the coast, and you know what that means. No, not more fog. It means Ruben is on vacation, and it's time for the Summer Mike Series. Here's your host for the Summer Mike Series, Crystalline.
This foggy, kind of rainy Friday. I hope you have relaxed plans. Even if you're at work, the Chamber of Commerce gives you permission to take it light today. I'm sure your bosses will love that. And I'm excited to be sharing the studio today with the El Granada Advocates. And if you would like to call in later and chat with them about all the great, wonderful topics they're going to cover today, you can check in with them at 650-560-9851. Good morning, wonderful women.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And please let the listeners know who you are and what great things you're working on.
Great. So I'm Melinda McNaughton, and I'm here with Jane Prey Silver, and we're with El Granada Advocates. And we are a group of community members in El Granada advocating for the conservation and protection of nature in El Granada to mitigate local climate change and preserve wildlife habitat. We focus on issues like reduction of pesticide use on public land. We have a pesticide petition on our website if you want to go look at it. And our website is egadvocates.org. We also currently supporting an initiative to stop the Harbor District from building a parking lot on Burnham Strip. And we have a link to the petition for that. And then we also advocate for protecting our trees on the medians, our historical medians in El Granada.
So today what we're going to discuss is how to reimagine your connection with nature. So Melinda, what would you like to discuss about nature today?
Well, I think in order to connect with nature, some of the scientific things that I have learned, I would like to talk about how healthy soil and lots of trees and vegetation can cool our climate during climate change and improve our chances of survival.
So can you tell us, Melinda, a little bit about your background?
Sure. I'm a dietitian with a master's degree in nutrition science from UC Davis and Texas Women's University. And I was inspired by the movie Kiss the Ground to take some coursework on soil. I took some coursework at the Soil Food Web online, and also some coursework from Kiss the Ground, because they have a lot of recent research and scientists they're working with help us learn about how plants can sequester carbon and trees can sequester carbon. And it's all about regenerative agriculture and working the land to help cool the climate.
So, Melinda, when I first met you, your kids were in middle school. And in full disclosure, I Googled you. And I could not believe the article in the Half Moon Bay Review showing you doing this kind of work when your children were quite little. Can you talk about the work you've done on this over the long haul?
Yeah, thank you. So I've been looking into the environment and research on pollutants since I had my first child 20-something years ago. And I was really concerned about what I put into my body because how it would affect her as she was growing in my belly. And so I did a lot of research into the pollutants that can get into our bloodstream and to the cord blood. And a lot of it was pollutants from pesticides, because that's a huge primary pollutant in the planet today, among other things. Since she was a baby, I had been researching it. An environmental working group is a good resource for information about that if you're interested. So I've been doing it for quite a long time. I also started at greenmoms.com, a local Green Moms group where we had fun events together and tried to learn information from each other about green living for our families.
So with a background in nutrition and in soil, can you tell us how nutrition is related to soil?
Yeah, so nutrition and soil are quite related, and our gut actually is quite related to the soil. So in the soil, scientists have discovered there's like a whole microbiome of different types of microbes and fungi that help support plant life. And in our gut, there's a diverse array of bacteria and microbes that help support our lives and even in our brains, too. And we need and rely on this good bacteria in order to survive and be healthy. And so does the soil. And what we put into our body all comes from the soil. Our food, everything comes from the soil. So we need to have healthy soil in order to have healthy lives and healthy bodies. And so that's, basically how it's related.
Yeah, so how can we relate something as, you know, humble as the soil that we have around us to something as big as climate change?
Right. What's the connection between soil and climate change? So recent research has indicated and shown that the microbes and fungi in the soil have a relationship with the plants. And so there is, instead of just our old theory about you stick a plant in the soil, it sucks up the nutrients, there is actually a symbiotic relationship between the microbes in the soil and the plants. They transfer things back and forth from each other. And one thing that the plants do is they capture carbon, the greenhouse gas, from our air and take it directly into the plant, so it builds the plant. And then they also transfer that carbon into the soil. So the soil is a huge bank for carbon sequestration, and so are the plants.
Okay, and you've done a massive amount on pesticides. This has been a big commitment of yours. Can you talk a little bit about your work there and what you've found?
Oh, yeah. So as far as pesticides go, I mean, in the big picture, in the big scheme of things, we found that pesticides kill the microbes and fungi in the ground, especially the non-specific ones. And so because the microbes and the fungi are related to plant life, that it has the same action on those fungi and microbes. So when you kill the soil, you have less nutrients in the soil, and the dead soil still supports certain plants, just the water, but it's not as effective at supporting plants that sequester a lot of carbon. The other thing about it is, if you look at the big picture, globally, the pesticide industry is a $80 billion industry, and they use about 400, I think it's million tons of pesticides approximately every year around the globe. And now that's everywhere. So they're using it not only on public lands, on nature preserves, in the war against invasive species, just continuously. It is being applied to hotel land, homeowner landscapes, pretty much everywhere you can think of, schools. I mean, not all of them, but in the ones where we have local protections, but golf courses. And the only protection against, you know, not using alternatives and organic pesticides that are food-based is when people speak up and municipalities pay attention and put regulations in to stop and limit the use. And unfortunately, here in San Mateo County, they're still using glyphosate and some harmful pesticides, even to pollinators. Yeah, so.
So for the listeners, what is it we can do at home that would help to capture the carbon and maybe create healthier soil in our landscapes and our homes?
I would say because the pesticide industry has constantly put pressure and it's been normalized to use pesticides, even, calling Orkin to spray for ants or to spray on your land for something, it's really important to know to not use pesticides on, because exponentially, if everybody did it, that's just, you know, creating a huge amount constantly being used. So if you can do on your own land without pesticides using alternative methods, and we have on our website a page you can go to, and I think it's under using pesticides in the neighborhood, and even not on our website, Poison-Free Malibu is a great website that I've linked to that has a ton of resources on how to manage pests and use alternatives to spraying weeds. The three things that you can do is cover your soil with something that feeds the soil that's biodegradable. So wood chips, mulch, leaves, dried leaves or leaves from your plants that feed the soil. That keeps the moisture in the soil, holds the water in, and you're going to use less water on your land, in your landscape. Planting trees and plants that are drought tolerant, native plants, and then having plants because you want to sequester carbon. And then the third thing is, where am I? I have the one last thing listed. Make compost and feed your plants with compost, because compost has the great bacteria and fungi in them to support the plant life.
Yeah, I was surprised, Melinda, when you had some presentations at the MCC to see the explosive use of pesticides worldwide. And, you know, there's an emphasis on eating organic, so we're not always aware. And, you know, I think the prevailing thought is a little bit won't hurt, but it's sort of like, I'd like to say a little bit of cocaine won't hurt. You know?
Right, and it's a little bit continuously, and what does that do?
Yeah,
the effects of that, and we have proof that it's very harmful.
So, Melinda, can you talk a little bit now about tree canopy and how that affects climate change?
Sure. So the loss of tree canopy affects climate change in that you have less cooling effect from the trees. So trees are so important in that they actually respirate out little particles of water that rain down on you that you can't see, that causes a cooling effect in the shade, you know, when you're under a tree in the shade. So they breathe out water, they breathe in water, they breathe out oxygen, they pull in water through their roots. There's a lot of things that they do, and they also prevent erosion and flooding with the water absorption. And just the tree roots being in the ground prevents the erosion. And globally, Tree City Pacifica, so that is a group I've been speaking with, and they have some great regulations for the protection of trees in Pacifica. And a lot of the, Pacific Grove does as well, a lot of the coastal towns do. She was pointing to, it's a 30% tree canopy goal for cities in order to keep a cooling effect as the climate heats up. And a 40% goal is the latest research now, by a university out in Australia.
So I noticed that San Francisco and also Paris have big projects to restore trees in their cities.
Right, and even Phoenix, Arizona, because they had pulled a bunch of trees out and they realized they were heating up too fast. So now they're putting them in.
Yeah, so I've been looking at the newest research from the wildfires. There's a lot of good information that came out about the LA fires. There's a, for the listeners, if you want to follow up and get the details, PBS has a special on what their findings were. And one of the findings that they discovered about California is that once a fire starts on a home, because property in California is so expensive, our homes are very close to one another. And once a home catches fire, it will send out embers for almost over an hour, sometimes 2 hours, depending on the size and the contents of the house. And it starts a domino effect. So one of the things they suggest is the more home hardening that we can have, the more natural fire breaks from the houses, we can stop this domino effect. And it used to be in the 1950s, you had 20 minutes to get out of your house. By today's standards, with so much petrochemical products in our homes, we now have 3 minutes. And if you don't have your car packed ahead of time, you're not going to have time to go fetch your documents and fetch your dog food and all of those things. So I've been thinking a little bit about something no one else is talking about, which is the idea of home hardening from the inside out. Let's get rid of the things we have in our house that are unnecessary. Our kids hold homework. I'm guilty of that. You know, shoes that don't fit. Let's, you know, we don't have to go to a minimize, but let's take a real look at can we make our homes more safe by looking at unnecessary contents.
That's amazing. I didn't even think about home hardening from the inside and how we have less time to get out now just because of the stuff on the inside of the house.
The other thing I've been thinking about is I did quite a bit of research on trying to home harden my house. And I think we need a shared website on resources. You know, it, when I looked at changing the gates, a minimum a fencer would charge was $10,000. They won't come out for any less than that. So you have to figure out, well, what else can I need to do? I looked at the cost of metal gates. They can be very expensive. And also finding the grates. They're $100 a piece, which is not very much. But if you've got 13 or 15 grates, then it adds up.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot for homeowners to do.
Yes. Sure. But I think this shared knowledge, we kind of have to take a community look at this because, you know, from the research of LA, we're all in this together.
Definitely. So I want to transition now and see, because you have a lot of information about what you want to talk about regarding our connection with nature. And it's very interesting. And I would like to see what is it that you specifically want to talk about and what do you want to start with, Jane?
Yeah, I think that we need to reimagine our relationship with nature. And I saved introducing myself till now. The resume part of me is that I was an educator, basically a curriculum developer for business and academia. And even on the coast side, I taught art for a while at the elementary school. But the more important part of me that relates to this topic is that I'm biracial. And that means I grew up in the 50s with a dad, and he was kind of a Robert Redford type. He was a descendant from Quentin Prey, who came over in 1647 on the Anne of Cleves to work in the foundries. And when I look at that background, I think, you know, the determination, the endurance, all of those are good qualities that I think as a culture we need to respect. And then on my mom's side, she was Chinese and Filipino. And I was introduced to more traditional and indigenous forms of looking at nature. Her grandfather knew herbalism and martial arts. And boy, she used to clear a headache with a Chinese soup spoon and a dipped in salt. And your headache would be gone like in 10 minutes. But wow. I want to discuss today. Oh, the last thing I just want to say is I just want to say a hello to my mom who's passed away. She grew up in a war zone. She was 14 when the war broke out. She was helping carry children on her shoulders to flee the troops. And by the time the war ended, she was 18, and she was working as a nurse, helping the soldiers. So she had a worldview about the value of humanity. And I feel like I really struck it rich having someone with that kind of knowledge. But anyway, one of the things that happened is coming out of the shadows of the 50s, I needed to, when I took a class at the community college, I needed to check whether I was, what race I was. And I realized that all my life I'd had this war inside of my head. Am I white or am I Asian? Which one should I choose? And it was at that very moment I decided that I was going to be both. And I changed my whole mindset from being dualistic to being pluralistic. And one of the things I want to do today is talk about nature and touch on various cultures and how they expand their relationship with nature. And it's kind of going to be a banquet. I'm just offering up ideas. If you're a Christian, and I'm talking about animism, and I'm not trying to persuade you one way or another. I honor all thoughts. So that's what I'd like to talk about.
Quite a diverse background, and I think that brings a lot of insight to how we could have different perspectives about nature and connect with nature. So I'm excited to go through your topics with you.
Yeah, I made a list, Melinda. So there's 8 ways of looking at nature, and I'll have you call them out as a reminder to me as I go through.
Sure. The first one is nature as a healer.
Yeah, so my mom, you know, she trusted nature first. And, like, if you were coming down with a cold, she would set up a makeshift sweat lodge in the backyard, which was basically an army cot with army blankets. You'd be wrapped up, and you would sweat the germs out, and then you'd be fine. And she also believed that trees could be healing, that you could actually get energy from trees. But I came across the work of Dr. Roger C. Holt. He was a vitamin D specialist, and he's talking about the trees in relationship to the infrared light that they give off. They give more infrared light off than just direct sunlight. And what they found, and probably people know this because they're using devices, but sunlight, infrared light specifically, can recharge your mitochondria, which means you can live longer, you can live healthier, your battery can be recharged.
And just want to say one thing about mitochondria. Those are the powerhouse of your cell. That's what gives your body energy.
Yes, yes. And so the tree canopy is something that is measured actually from outer space by seeing this extra infrared light being reflected. There are more deaths when the days are shorter, which are December and January in the United States, and then the reverse in Australia.
Huh.
So the other thing about that this Dr. Roger C. Holt mentioned is that they used to think that people living in affluent neighborhoods, they had more access to healthy food and they have more access to exercise, time for exercise, gym memberships. And they're beginning to think that because these neighborhoods have more trees, people that live there may be actually living in a blue zone where they're getting their mitochondria recharged from these trees.
Wow, that is interesting. Is that new research that you found?
Well, it's new to me.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So here, you know, taking forest baths, as the Japanese call them, is good. Eating in season, so you're triggering your body about when you're going to be in a high metabolism versus a low metabolism state is also good.
Wow. Okay. So did you want to move on to the next topic?
Yeah,
then?
Let's
nature
do that.
As a mother.
Yeah, you know, I think we're very conflicted about nature being a mother. It's a symbolic phrase that we don't always relate directly to. An example I think of is the Hopi Indians. Their story of origin is that they came out of the earth. And when they tried to raise food, it was very difficult. And so the spirit world that was still in the ground took pity on human beings. And the spirits came out and helped show the Hopi how to raise food. These are the Kachina spirits, which you've probably heard of Kachina dolls. And they come out as their promise to mankind to come out during planting and harvest season to help human beings. And when you think about a culture that literally believes that we were birthed out of the womb of the earth, it takes on not a symbolic meaning, but a really relativistic meaning about our relationship to Mother Earth who sustains us.
That we are actually from the earth and connected to the earth. Yeah.
Yeah, the other little story I wanted to share with you is that I did some reading on the Philippines, and during harvest time when they would collect the rice, they would take a week or two to do nothing. You know, you wouldn't start a house or a new endeavor. You would meditate, and you would make sure that your alignment with nature was clear. And the reason that you did that is that when you harvest the rice, you are approaching the spirits that live in the rice. And they're going to look at you and say, do you have a pure heart? Do you come with the right attitude? And if you do, and you've interacted with those spirits, they remember and they will give you a bountiful harvest the next year. And maybe that sounds a little extreme, but I have an example, you know, how we readjust our attitude. I heard a policeman say he had problems with his family because he was coming home with the warrior spirit. And he learned to step aside, readjust, put on the loving husband and father persona, and then he could come into his family. So I think we can check ourselves a little bit with...
Oh, it's almost like an attitude change.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah. And then you have some ideas and information that you've read about nature as a relative.
Yeah, so the Cherokee believe in tribes, and we also see that same feeling in the Canadian totems. And this is not a symbolic relationship. You know, for us, symbols are a little different. We see symbols as this means that. There's a kind of removed aspect. For more traditional cultures, symbolism is actually something that holds energy or has a direct message. So when they talk about being part of a clan, they're talking about being related by blood to that animal. And then we ask, well, how can that possibly be? And it's because they believe in shape-shifting. So there's a wonderful podcast called Animism is Normative by the Emerald Group that you can listen to that's extremely good and basically covers the fact that animism, it's really a very old tradition that ripples through all cultures. But I'll tell a quick story about a Siberian story about a hunter. There was a hunter who, he left his house. He told his wife, I'm going to go get us some dinner. Our provisions are low. So he goes out into the forest, and he can't find anything. He's looking everywhere. He's hiding in the bushes. He's moving. He's walking another mile because maybe there's something over there. He can't find anything. And the day is coming to an end, and he's exhausted. So he says, well, that's it. I'm going home. So as he's walking, he runs into another villager. And the villager says, you look exhausted. And he says, I couldn't find any food. And so the stranger says, well, why don't you come home with me? You can take a rest, and my wife and I will feed you. And, you know, you can regenerate. So the hunter says, thank you so much. So he walks with this villager to a little, plain little cottage. It's humble, but it's warm inside, and there's really delicious food there. And he has dinner. He falls asleep because he's so tired. And he wakes up late at night, and he realizes, I need to go home. My wife's going to be so worried. So he slips out the door, and he walks home. And it's a full moon, and he's trying to hurry. And he glances down at the earth, and he sees his footprints left behind when he went to the cottage. And he notices something quite strange, which is that there's deer tracks, and it was actually deers who'd shapeshifted to invite him to dinner.
Well, thank you so much. Wow, this is really, really interesting stuff, and it's just fascinating sitting here getting to listen to you guys and all of this interesting stuff. I'm excited that you guys are here to help El Granada through all of its various transitions. Quick question. We're going to head out to a break in about a minute, but as somebody who goes to all of the MCC meetings, and how did your group get involved in doing presentations with the MCC meetings to help, like, this, you know, show today, like, educate the community? Like, what brought you to wanting to not just do this for yourself and for your family and keep it kind of singular and insular and really try to educate others on these topics?
Oh, well, I think we just had a passion for protecting what we think is important in nature in El Granada. And first of all, it started with the median trees. They were threatened to be cut down. Some of them were cut down a while ago. And then we started learning about the pesticide use on public lands in the county. And so we went to the MCC, and we got together with some anti-pesticide advocates, and they helped us figure out how we could connect with our politicians about it and try and work with our politicians on it. And MCC, bringing it to the MCC, was important to do a presentation there and get it out to the public.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's very, very cool. Can't wait to hear more about it after this break.
This is Community Radio for the Coast Side. 100.9 KHMB. Coastal Windage is brought to you by Cameron's Restaurant and Pub in Half Moon Bay. Come for the food, stay for the fun. That's Cameron's Restaurant and Pub on Highway 1 in Half Moon Bay.
Hi, this This is Jay Michaels. Make sure to join me and Stan Warren Littrell coming up at 10 o'clock right after Coastal Windage. We'll have a look at today in history, plus we'll get to a brand new forgotten find. It all happens at 10 a.m. right here from 100.9 FM KHMB.
And we're back. Thank you, Coastside, for hanging out with us and have two wonderful women with us today, Melinda and Jane from El Granada Advocates, who are really just educating our area on the benefits of nature and how, you know, people make decisions in one realm but don't always think about the consequences in another realm. So thank you for being with us, and just love hearing all of this information. So please continue on with your wonderful story and education.
Thanks, Crystal, and thanks for having us today. So, Jane, you were just finishing talking up about nature as a relative, and you said you were talking about the story about how the deer were actually the entity that had this hunter into their home. So can you kind of just summarize what the point of that story was?
Really, that more traditional cultures really feel connected to the animal world in a way that is somewhat beyond our imagination. I mean, the closest we come is that we're related to some kind of monkey species, but that's very removed, you know, and we think of the ocean as being maybe where we were birthed from. So I think it's really worth understanding that one cultural viewpoint is that we are literally related to the animal species. And one thing, just to conclude on that topic, I went to a seminar held by Michael Harner. He had people draw pictures of trees and discuss their relationship with trees. I've never been to a seminar like that where everyone ended up crying. And the men in the group were crying. And you realize that when children feel lost, they sometimes climb up into trees and they feel that love from the trees. So just wanted to put that in there as well to finish that topic.
Well, that's really interesting. Is there an exercise people could do so they could be like learn how to become more connected? Is that kind of one of the things, is where you kind of write down your relationship to trees, or think about it, like how you felt about it as a kid?
Yeah, one thing people are doing is that when they see an animal, they think, what is this animal trying to teach me? And I have a weird example. I have always thought, and people are going to say this is strange, but I've always thought cranes are rather awkward when I see them walking. Their head and their bodies are almost moving in different time zones. And I saw a crane flying, and I thought, wow, how graceful that is. And I asked myself, is there a lesson for me to learn from this? And I thought, you know what? Sometimes it's the things we're most embarrassed about or we struggle the most with that we want to hide. And when we share them with other people, or we share the lessons from them, or we get information from other people, we've now turned something shameful and difficult and challenging into something beautiful, because now we've got wisdom that can be shared with other people.
Okay. So your next topic is... Crystalline, did you have anything you wanted to say?
You
kind of looked like it, that's why I was...
Yeah. So, first of all, it looks like we actually might have a caller.
Oh, okay.
And if anybody else wants to call in, 650-560-9851. Hey, caller, who do we have with us today?
Hi, my name is Jacob. Mr. Bob Hansen and I, we are local website designers here in San Jose. We're wondering if you're interested about building...
Sorry, you have called a live radio show, so we won't be taking any website advice at this moment, but please feel free to call back never. thank you so much. The question that I had, and to your, something that you just mentioned about, you know, kids having a propensity to climb up into the trees, and... you see that in a lot of movies and things like that. I personally am afraid of heights, so that's not where I would go, but, so I think that's a very cool concept. And something that we had kind of talked about when we met for a coffee before the show. And, you know, you, Jane, had mentioned that you know, people are coming from animals. And I just wanted to say that we had chatted earlier, and regardless of whether somebody feels that we came from a, like, scientific background or if it was a, you know, Bible-driven background, you know, there's the two areas. Either way, people started in both theories. People started in a garden or an outdoor space, and, you know, cities have taken, you know, eons and eons to build. So we weren't born to, or we weren't brought here to this space thinking that we were going to live in cement jungles. Like, those are all things that are manufactured.
Right. We didn't start in cities. We yes. started in caves and trees, actually.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Yeah. And so I just find that really, really fascinating if you think back to the, you know, thousands and thousands of years that people have been on this planet. The way that we know the planet today is just vastly different than how our ancestors were living on this planet. And I just, yeah, I just find that very interesting. And something that you had said, Jane, had really just struck that in me. So.
Right. And I think the cities, living in cities, has essentially kind of disconnected us with the earth and how to take care of the earth and being close to the earth, because we're not close to the earth as much anymore. We are in buildings most of the time.
Yeah. I feel for I think for a long time, you know, what you learn in the history books and in school and all of these things, and just from day-to-day experience, for a very long time, the earth was seen as a resource and a resource only, that it was just here to provide materials for us to get to the next, get to the next, get to the next.
Right.
Whereas in reality, regardless of where we came from, the earth was meant to be our home in its natural state.
Right.
I love that analogy.
I love that.
Of the Garden of Eden, because it's basically saying we had nature all around us. It provided everything that we need. We were happy there. And because we transgressed, we lose that. And now we are cut off from nature. And our striving is to return to that place. And it's a wonderful metaphor for what we're struggling to do now.
I think I agree, because that was abundance, right? The Garden of Eden. And if we were more connected, we would have more abundance. If we understood how to work with nature instead of trying to control it and get from it and take from it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So your next thing is nature as a teacher you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, we'd get back to symbolism. The Tree of Life is basically a universal symbol through all cultures. The Vikings, the Judaic artwork, and in India, we see the Tree of Life. And what this represents, just on a surface level, is it's telling us we should be rooted in the nutrition of the soil. We're grounded. Our trunk is how we present ourselves to the nature around us and the world around us. And then the very last component is reaching up into the heavens and being a spiritual person as well. So that is why the Tree of Life becomes so important. It's a microcosm of how we navigate the world from a wisdom standpoint. But one of the things that happens in our culture is that if we want to find out what we should major in or what we should work in, we get a book on it, we ask our friends. And one of the interesting things as nature's teacher is the Native Americans had the vision quest. So you're going to go out into nature completely by yourself. And you're going to ask nature, what is it I'm supposed to be doing? And nature is going to find a way to talk to you, to instruct you on the best way to live your life. The Aborigines have walkabouts to do something similar. And so it's how to develop. I tried to ask what makes a good relationship, and one of them is good, solid communication. And so how do we develop that? And one way I think we do need to think is scientific methodology has us think in buckets, and nature is really a holistic enterprise in a way.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so the Native Americans also would go out and just observe nature. And I think they learned a lot about how to,
I mean, they were connected with it. So they learned how to work with nature by watching it and understanding how it worked and what it did in order to create abundance for themselves.
It's also the smart culture. It's also the smart path of least resistance, right? So if you actually take the time to learn about how the things around you are working, you then can work with those things to get what you need versus what I think a lot of us are trained to do at this point, which is to take an opinion and try to ramrod it through. And that usually ends up making things much, much more clunky and difficult than they need to be.
True. Versus, and people don't want to listen because they feel like they're being bossed around.
Yes. Yes. I think, we're coming up into generations of, my way or the highway. But, but I think there's lessons to be learned in that taking time, I know for myself with the way that my chamber job works, right? I'm consistently working on, 17 different projects in 17 different realms and all these things. And if I try to go fast and not take the time, then I end up with less than stellar projects because I've not taken that time to learn about them. And things start falling through the cracks because you're just moving too fast and this and that. And so I really truly believe, taking that time to learn about what's happening around you so that you can use it to benefit your end goal is really important. And it's a skill and a concept that seems to be getting lost in as time goes on, as people are just trying to produce more from less, produce more from
results.
Less.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. There's a saying in finance, the more complex the situation is, the more cautiously you should move forward. And there's nothing more complex than nature. And I almost wish that when we come up with a solution, we would do a risk analysis to see, well, what other things can happen if we take an extreme hand to nature.
Yeah. So your next topic is energy giver. Nature as an energy giver. And you kind of covered that with the ultraviolet red.
Yeah.
Was it the red?
Yeah, the infrared.
Infrared.
So just to finish up about the symbology of learning from nature, I've been studying the I Ching again. It's actually pronounced I Ching, but nobody will know what I'm talking about if I don't mispronounce it. But what's interesting about that is you were talking about how people read nature. And so for the Chinese tradition, each of the elements, there's about 8 nature elements, and they carry a message with them. For instance, water is movement. A lake is joy. And so it's divided into a hexagram, which means you look into the heavens. What's going on in the heavens? And what am I observing on the earth? And the example that's easiest to understand is water over water. So if you were to get that in the I Ching, it's saying it's going to rain hard and the ground is already saturated. We know that that means it's flood conditioned. So if you were in China and the I Ching reader would get that, they would say, it's not a good time to have a wedding. It's not auspicious. It's not a good time to start building your new house. So nature becomes this symbol to inform us. And I know with the Native Americans, they became so adept at reading nature. They noticed if the spiders were building their webs very low, heavy rain was coming. And we've lost the ability to, and it may be more important right now as we see climates changing, for us to learn to read nature again.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything you have on that?
Oh, I do find it very, very interesting about looking to animals to know what's coming down the pipe. Like, it's so interesting that their senses are so acute and so in tune with their surroundings that, if you have something unfortunate like a wildfire or something, one of the first signs that it's even just brewing is that the deer and the mountain lions and, all of the animals start heading, away.
Yeah.
So it's like if you're on a hike and you're hiking and all of a sudden you're just noticing, species after species kind of heading the other way, whether you see it or not. And so I think that's really cool and interesting about the spiders, about where they're putting their webs. And I believe that that's also part of the reason that there's, you know, the Dark Skies Initiative, right? Because, you know, the man-made things and the lights being a certain way and a certain brightness, you know, have messed with the birds and the nocturnal animals. And
absolutely.
And
yeah.
So I do, again, just the animal aspect of it and yeah. their senses and actually taking the time to acknowledge and watch what they're doing to help inform what might be coming down the pipe. I'm a huge, huge sci-fi fan. I watch more sci-fi movies than one probably should. But, you know, there's always some, you know, loving scientist or person who's the paleontologist or whatever. That's always the first one to be like, you know, this probably means that.
Right.
And then there's the 800 people that don't listen. And then the thing happens and it's, I think animals
are... And he's
are,
like, I told you guys. Come on.
Yes, yes.
I know, it's true. So your next topic was nature as an energy. Wait, did I already say that?
Yeah, we're going to do that. No.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So I just want to take a little pause here and sing a song to you. I took the time to learn Lakota, which I think is a very beautiful language. And this is a lullaby that the mothers would sing to their babies. And basically the message is, don't be afraid of the dark. And that is, I think, a universal message, is we cannot be afraid of nature. We need to repartner and love and respect nature and understand and ask her what her needs are so she can continue to ask us what our needs are.
Just before you go, we have 13 minutes.
We're good.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not a singer, so I'm only singing this for cultural reference. But I think one of the things I love about this song is the first two notes sound like a bird taking off from the ground.
Wow, that was beautiful.
That was.
Thanks,
it's a beautiful
Jane,
language.
Okay, next time, don't put the caveat that you're not a good singer.
You are a good singer.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
There's different reasons to sing, and I think people get ashamed because we use it for entertainment, but it's a way of reoxygenating. It's a way of expressing yourself, and it can be a spiritual call to the spirits to come into your life.
And it's proven to change your mood. So they say, like, if you are really feeling kind of depressive, listening to music is like one way to kind of try to change that, but singing along will take you like that next step.
That's pretty cool. I didn't realize that about singing.
Yes. Cool. Yes. So when I go do karaoke at Cameron's Pub, I am really just bringing myself back to center.
Nice. Hey. Oh, that's smart.
Okay. So I'm going to go through the rest of it because we have quite a few topics and I'm going to try to trim them down a bit.
Nature as an energy giver?
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, when you look at the medicine wheel, it touches all four corners of the earth. It's inclusive. And I've just been looking at fractals. I have to admit, I'm not an expert and this is a pretty complex topic. But just for reference, there's a book called The Fractal Geometry of Nature by Benoit Mandelbrot. And Sarah Campbell has written one called Mysterious Patterns. So just to clarify, I'm sure there's mathematicians thinking, wow, she's got this so wrong. There's mathematical fractals, which are forms based on, not on integers, but on fractions. And then there's nature-based fractals, like we see when lightning strikes. And what the value of fractals is they are... what I have heard, the use of fractal light stimuli can help restore the functions of the brain is what they're finding. Because we were raised, as Crystalline said, in a complex environment. And so fractals, if you're looking at trees, you've got an infinite number of variations and you've got an infinite number of similarities. Our brain is programmed for that. It's programmed to that because, for instance, if we're looking for water and we hear a babbling brook, oh, there's water down there. That's what that means. And it happens a second time. Now we've learned through pattern. We go down to the brook one day and it's dry. Now we have difference. I think, oh, how am I going to tell? Oh, well, the leaves are brown. So because we're, our mind is programmed to work finding patterns and differences. When we get out into nature, we see that complexity. I've heard it's
infinite complexity in a finite space, and yet we're living in cubes. And so we need to get out. People with Alzheimer's are being tested now to see if this helps. And people who have eye problems are being tested for that. So as far as, I just skip ahead here.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to mention a little bit about how to use energy, nature as an energy giver. And one example would be the hedge walkers. And the hedge walkers are related to, also to hedge witches. And what that is about is that there's a belief there's an extra energy field wherever there's seams in the earth. So where a mountain turns into a valley, where the ocean turns in, the sand turns into an ocean, those are high energy points. And I think because of what happened 300 years of women being accused of being witches, they were the carriers of our relationship with nature to a very large extent.
Hmm.
I think we have epigenetic damage from 300 years. And one of the things I found astonishing in my reading is one of the reasons that witchcraft was hammered so, you know, strongly is because a lot of the medieval people didn't believe in it. They didn't believe that the woman down the street who'd sold them a lotion for their back pain was the reason their chicken died. You know, and we ask, well, why does the image of a witch look like grandma? She's smiling, she's on a broom, and it looks like grandma. And the reason is because historically, when a woman became a widow, she had property. And she would normally try to go into her garden and make potions, of, you know, healing potions. She'd help with childbirth. And she was the one, because a lot of times they wanted her land, would be accused of something. She probably had no idea what the word meant. So
interesting.
Just a word on that.
That's an interesting parallel possibility as to why we are less connected to nature.
I think that when we have constrained language, it shows that we have we are not looking holistically at something. And so now what we're seeing is a lot of adjectives being used as women try to reclaim that space with nature. We have words like Christian witch, because somebody says, I want to be close to nature, but I'm not consorting with, you know, the devils.
Interesting.
So we have that. The other thing that happens in this space is we know that the ocean and the moon are tightly related, and the tides are different when the moon is full. The animals are more active, and so some people, you know, get aligned with drinking moon water or sitting in the moonlight to alter that water in their bodies.
So we have maybe about 6 minutes left. Do you want to pick one of the most important topics left there for your you're passionate about?
Yeah, I'll just condense this into a quick thing.
Okay.
So as far as nature as an illuminator for growth, this is the one where we bring our judgment to nature. I think that the Christian Judaic tradition is very good because it emphasizes morality, and certainly that's a wonderful thing to keep society together. But when we bring it to nature and we decide something's good and something's bad, we're kind of operating in a dangerous space. So as an example, if you have a garden, and you see your carrots growing, you say, carrots are good. You see a gopher, you think gopher is bad. But if you do the more research, you find out that gophers have a job, and that is to create topsoil, which is why they're bringing, they're digging and they're bringing things down into the earth. And my personal one was worms. I can't stand worms. But there's work by a Dr. Ishmael in Delhi and Kanpur in India. They use their native worms to reduce pollutants. So in the soil, when they put the worms down in that soil, they have found that 50% of the diesel that's been spilled will be cleaned up in 70 days. So here again is an example where we really need to understand nature and its purpose. Even weeds, I know they have large tap roots. So when you see them in with the lot with the discarded trash and tires, they're busy trying to break up the soil so something more beautiful or that
more plants can grow.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah.
Because nature likes to be covered with plants.
So I'll just finish up with talking a little bit about nature as a spiritual partner. The work of Vine Deloria is worth looking into. It really is
the bringing together of quantum physics and the traditions of the Native American Lakotas. And I think that's worth looking into. And then as far as nature as a great mystery, there's a lot of work being done right now on water. The first work was by Masi Yamamoto, who showed water crystals are sensitive. They're emotionally sensitive. So he taped on the word love, and he got beautiful crystals, and he taped
when
on...
When he froze it? Yeah,
well,
when he froze
he
the water?
No, he just... I guess he must have to see the crystals.
Right, it was water first, and then he froze it.
And then hate would be, you know, very distorted. There's another woman, and now I'm entering into the woo-woo part, which is probably good so that nobody will call in to object. But the work of Veda Austin is very, very interesting. She played the Stairway to Heaven to some water, and she got stairway images. She took pictures of dogs, and she taped them to these same process, to the pipettes with water, and then she froze it. And she didn't get a copy of the photograph. She got an image of a dog. And the latest thing she said is she started to ask how she can communicate with nature, and she started getting something that looks like cuneiform. And she says when AI gets more sophisticated, she's going to see if this perhaps is a language. So that's the more far out research that's being done. But one theory is that our memory as a human race is carried not by our brains, which die, but through the water.
Interesting.
And what I'm doing lately is, you know, I'm a very prayerful person. I have a bowl of water, and I place my prayers underneath that bowl of water to amplify them.
Interesting. Wow. So water, I mean, our bodies are made of, what, 70-80% water? So if water does carry memory, and if water mimics, like, emotions or information, it would be very interesting that we actually learn through that or feel it.
And the earth is mostly water.
Yeah.
You know, I think nature is both mysterious and complex, and the Lakota call God Wankatanka, and that doesn't translate to God. It translates to the great mystery. And if we realize that in our own imaginations, nature is more infinite than we have imagined, it's more finite than we've imagined, and it's more complex than we've imagined, we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, it's hard if you think that way about nature being so complex that it's hard to, like, think implementing one solution to fix something is not going to cause consequences in the long run.
Yeah, I mean, we have to start one footstep at a time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we as people, we know a lot, but we also know a little.
Exactly. Yes. There's so much always to learn. That's true. So we invite people to join EGA. We've had a bat walk before. We have a naturalist, and we didn't even know we had bats on our coast, but we actually have bats in our medians. We have bats at Quarry Park. They live in the trees.
They were at my neighbor's house.
They were?
Yeah.
Oh, my
gosh. They had to change their front entryway to be less bat-friendly so that they weren't barraged every morning.
Barraged by bats.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they love to live in any little cracks and crevices. Let's see, what else was I going to say? Oh, yeah, I mean, there's lots of photographers on the coast here. I know there's a ton of people that appreciate nature on the coast, and we have a photographer that puts her photos up on our website, too. So please come join us, egadvocates.org, E as in egg, G as in George, advocates.org, and
there's
check us out.
Wonderful people at EG Advocates. So
yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. This was just a wonderful listening session and learning session about our local area and how we can be more thoughtful. And thank you, and we look forward to checking in with you in a little while.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having us. Thanks so much.